On today's program, our guest is Robert Rosenberg, co-director of Flint Hills Renewable Energy and Efficiency Cooperative. Robert will speak on the availability and advantages of solar-generated electricity. But first, the environmental news for the week of December 10th on EcoRadio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. USA Today reports, California authorities have broken up a smuggling ring that was hauling empty cans and bottles into California so they could cash in on the recycling refund. Three suspects were arrested in a case that resulted in a fraudulent payout totaling $16 million in over 3 years. About 30,000 pounds of empty beverage containers were seized in a Phoenix collection yard. Authorities said that was bound for California, which pays 5 to 10 cents per container. In 2018 so far, 27 people in three states have been arrested in similar charges of smuggling. There have been cases in California, Nevada, and Washington. Democracy Now! Reports, a new report finds Greenland's ice sheet is melting at the fastest rate in centuries as atmospheric carbon dioxide levels from human activity continue to increase to historic highs. Writing in the journal Nature, a team of international researchers warns that not only is Greenland's melt beginning to add to global sea level rise, but the rate of the melt is accelerating. Reuters reports, a powerful winter storm that hit the United States southeast over the weekend knocked out power for more than 300,000 customers and forced the cancellation of hundreds of flights. The National Weather Service said a reported between 4 and 12 inches of snow in some areas of northwestern North Carolina and southwestern Virginia have occurred. This is more unusual weather. According to a media report on Friday, the Trump administration is set to reduce the number of federally regulated waterways protected under the United States Clean Water Act in a bid to help the energy and agriculture industries. There is a diplomatic standoff over a single word during the second half of this year's UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland. Negotiators take time out to rest after the first week of talks ended on a sour note when the United States sided with Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait in blocking endorsement of the landmark study, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's special report on what would happen if average global temperatures continued to rise. The report has been widely regarded as a wake-up call for policymakers when it was released in October. Almost all 200 countries present in Katowice, Poland, had wanted to welcome the IPCC report, making it the benchmark for future action. But the United States and three other countries objected. While none of the four oil-exporting countries spelled it out, their objection to the report likely included its suggestion that fossil fuel use needs to be phased out by 2050. The four are United States, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Russia. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Katowice, Poland all week. The Climate Energy Project announces the 2018 Climate Plus Energy Award winners, Larry Erickson, KSU Kim E. and Food Science Professor, Bob I., attorney, Elena Alterman, Kansas Health Foundation, Project Rally, Kansas nonprofit, Scott White, Clean Energy Champion, and Gary Anderson, dedicated environmental volunteer. Today I'm happy to be speaking with Robert Rosenberg, who's an assistant director of the Flint Hills Renewable Energy and Efficiency Cooperative, which is incorporated in the city of Manhattan, Kansas. Robert, thank you for coming to KKFI.
Thank you for having me.
So I first heard of you, I live in Lawrence, and I saw in the newspaper you were going to speak, and the topic of your presentation was solar energy for everyone. I wasn't able to attend that program, but you spoke again in Topeka, and I did drive and hear that, and your presentation is something that everyone needs to hear. That's why we have invited you on Eco Radio KC. So tell us what your group does, please.
Sure. First of all, I'm glad you came to Mother Earth News and heard the presentation. I'm willing to give the presentation anywhere, anytime. It's the Flint Hills Renewable Energy and Efficiency Co-op, Flint Hills Solar Co-op, or we call ourselves the Freaks, are volunteers who help people put up solar panels on their roof, on their roofs, or, well, ground mounts, or wherever. Recently, because it's the prices have come down so much and the equipment has become so safe that volunteers like us, with very little knowledge of construction, can help people and install panels for people. We hold sunraisers, which are like barn raisers, neighbors helping neighbors. There's one going on right now in Olsburg, Kansas. We like the model, the Freak model, to spread. We'd like to see other groups in Kansas City, Missouri area, wherever, to follow our lead and help people learn a little bit about how to install solar panels, which recently have become so easy and plug and play that that they can help other people do it.
So as I understand you, the rules are south-facing roof or on the ground for an array, south-facing, and then the array is hooked to a photovoltaic adapter. Is that what you call that magic piece?
Well, the magic piece, photovoltaic, is what the whole system is, how the whole solar panel system is referred to. We can use the sun to make energy, and you can heat hot water with the sun, and it's a solar panel that heats hot water. But what the Flint Hills Solar Co-op does is install PV, photovoltaic. We make electricity tied to the grid. What was your question again?
You have an array. You have the collector, and then the collector needs to be plugged into something that plugs into the home's power source.
Okay, sorry. The microinverter. Yeah. The modern innovation in the last 12 years or so has been the microinverter, which what it does is it takes the electricity from the solar panel, which is DC, and inverts it to household 240 volt AC current. The systems we install have a panel and an inverter as a unit, one inverter for each panel. Now, it's important to realize that we are tied to the grid. In other words, we're not off-grid. There are no batteries. These systems are modular. You can have one panel or four panels. I started out with three, got 10, and then a few years later added three more.
On your home, you have 13.
On my home, exactly.
And this home, how many bedrooms do you have in your home?
Three bedrooms. It's a 1,700 square foot home, and we don't have the greatest of sun. The panels are south facing, but there are some shade trees in the area. But we still get enough sun to purchase 3/4 of our electricity.
So essentially, your monthly home electric bill is a third of what it was before you put these solar panels in place, correct?
Yes. It's as though I'm buying electricity from myself. Or the way I like to put it is it's as though I paid the utility company in advance for 7 or 8 years, and then I get 17 years or 25 years, or they're guaranteed. The panels are guaranteed for 25 years. So if it's like paying my electric bill in advance for 8 years and getting the next 17 years for free minimum, because the panels, they degrade about 0.5% a year, but that's pretty low. And the panels that were built in the 70s are still generating electricity, and the panels they make right now are much better than the ones they've made in the 70s.
Now, you referenced to this point that historically early solar panels heated water, and that was hot water rises and then gravity made it fall, and that was a system for homes that worked effectively using the sun. Under this more modern system that you're putting in place, the home still uses a electric hot water heater? Is this true?
Well, yes, you can use an electric hot water heater, and that's the beauty of electricity, is that you can use it to run computers and everything in your home as well as your electric water heater. Now, putting hot water, making hot water is efficient using the sun, but it's in this climate having hot water that having water on the roof is dangerous because of the it freezes. They often use fluids that have heat exchangers, and it gets a lot more complicated. They put hot water solar on the White House in the 70s, and they took it off, and I don't know why, but I assume it's because they didn't want to have any risk to the White House. However, now there are solar panels, PV on the White House.
Now there are panels on the White House. Obama put them back on.
And I doubt if anybody would take them off because they are, it saves them money.
The history of the White House, Jimmy Carter put the panels up. Ronald Reagan took them off. Nobody really said. Jimmy Carter talked a lot about why he was putting them up. He was interested in protecting the environment. Reagan took them off, and then Obama has put them back on, and they still are up because the new systems of arrays are made out of polyvinyl, and so they're lighter weight and stronger. Is that the point of these modern systems?
I don't think the weight was much of an issue. I shouldn't have distracted us, but my point was that in the White House in the 70s, they were water. It was to heat water because PV was it hadn't come to the point that it is now. Our systems now generate electricity, and the beauty of them is that they have been designed to work with the grid. They only work when they detect the grid, which makes it safe for people like volunteers like the Flint Hills Co-op to put panels on roofs. We're not dealing with high voltage DC on a roof. We're dealing with solar panels that weigh about 40 pounds that generate electricity only when they are safely connected.
And your experience with these solar panels, Robert, what's the downside of a person using solar for electricity in their residential home?
Well, I can't think of a downside. Maybe if if your roof is old and it's going to need to be replaced, maybe it'd be a little bit more of a nuisance to have to take the panels off to put a new roof on. But roofs are guaranteed for like 40 years. So if your roof is 20 years old, put panels on, and it'll protect the roof a little longer. The panels degrade. That should stop people from putting up solar panels on their roof is shade. The expense is it's about $400 a panel, and the systems are modular, so you could put one panel on your roof. You wouldn't generate much electricity, maybe enough for the lighting in your home if you're using LEDs or something. It's not going to generate much, but it will generate electricity that you don't have to buy. Now, everything I'm saying is dependent, financial, economical considerations are dependent on what the utility company does, whether they charge you or whether they buy your electricity at a fair rate or they don't, or they penalize you, as what's happened recently with the KCC in Kansas, and is happening with KCPNL in Kansas also.
In Kansas City. But before we leave the disadvantages of solar electricity, Robert, the sun only shines in the daytime. So what I anticipated your response was going to be, yes, you have electricity while the sun is shining, and then at night and when we need lights and on cloudy days, we don't have electricity. So your system, how do you work around that? How do you see that?
Yeah, I forgot all about that nighttime thing. Like I said, the panels, the systems are tied to the grid. So we make electricity when the sun shines. If you take a $400 panel and put it in your roof and plug it in and lay it in the sun, it's going to generate electricity. Now, when the cloud comes over or it gets dark, you'll be buying from the grid. The electrons that your solar panel makes will seek the path of least resistance. They'll go into your home first if you've got something on. And if you don't have anything on, they'll go to the grid and go to your neighbor's house who has something on. Now, the beauty of solar, I know they only work during the day, but the utility company has a problem with generating electricity during hot summer days. That's when those are the peak demand days. And solar panels meet a lot of that peak. Not all of it, but most of it. The shortfalls between the hours of, let's say, when the sun's starting to go down at 5 o'clock and people's air conditioners are still cranking because it's hot, those shortfalls can be made up with other methods of maybe turning off your, setting the thermostat on your air conditioner to go off between those hours. There's lots of things that the utility company can do and we can do. But downsides of solar, they don't require any maintenance. It's the difference between solar and wind. Wind requires maintenance and has to be on towers, and people who are afraid of heights don't like that. But they degrade 0.5% a year. They work better when they're cold. Let's see, downsides.
Well, this is the really exciting news. With the new systems, people can put a solar array on the roof of their house, and electricity comes through this converter.
Inverter.
From the inverter. So it comes into the units, air conditioner, oven, lights, whatever you're using when you turn the switch on. And the homeowner doesn't have to trip a switch to make it be off the grid or off the solar, correct? Anytime you flip a switch, it works. Am I understanding this?
Yes, that's exactly how it works. You don't have to think about it. Now, if something were to go wrong with an inverter, then you might not ever know it if you don't pay any attention. But fortunately, these systems they send a signal out to the cloud, and so they are constantly monitoring themselves. And if an inverter failed, you'd get an email. At least the stuff that the equipment we put on, you get an email from the manufacturer that says you got a problem with an inverter, and it'll give you the serial number. And of course, if you're organized and have it mapped out, you can know exactly which inverter is giving you the problem. It's never happened to me, but it has happened to we've installed over 50 installations with, let's say, an average of 10 to 15 panels. So, out of the hundreds of panels, we've only had a few failures, and it could have been from lightning. There's a problem. Hail, not so much. They can withstand a lot of hail, but we have had one panel that got hit by a hail ball that broke it. But it was insured. Not too many problems.
So the material is rather like what's on a cell phone. It cracks, but it doesn't break and shatter like glass, right?
It's glass. It's tempered glass. But, you know, tempered glass is really strong. I saw a video. You can find a video online that where they're bouncing golf ball size hail at 250 miles an hour at it, and it just bounces off.
And then without a doubt, whether a person had their collector hooked to a cloud so that your smartphone was telling you of the type of solar you're using, you'll see it when the monthly electricity bill comes, because with a working inverter, your electricity use is a third as much. And so when your electric bill goes up, you're taking more from the grid. That would be apparent to anyone, correct?
Well, yeah, and it's even a little cooler than that. You can go out to your meter and watch the dots go backwards. You know, in the old days, it was more fun because you could watch the wheel go backwards on your electric meter. But now you can watch the dots go backwards, and so you can tell your system is working. And your bill, well, you know, my bill went down two-thirds, but that all depends on how many panels you got. Some people don't have any bill, you know, and some people just a few panels. But like I said, it's like paying your utility bill in advance and getting, you know, years for free. And if you borrow money, or another way to look at it is like an 8% interest bank account. You know, when you put money in the bank, you get money, at like 2% interest. It's going to take you 25 or 30 years to get your initial investment back. And you still, of course, have your initial investment. Solar panels are that way, only they're more like an 8% interest bearing account.
Robert, if you'd be so good as to give everyone your contact information, both your website and if there's a phone number to call the Freak Collective, that would be terrific.
Well, yeah, you can reach us at mail@freak.org. Let's see, what would be the simplest way? Probably that is the simplest way to get a hold of us is mail@freak.org. FHREEC, Flint Hills Renewable Energy and Efficiency Co-op. You can look up, if you look up Flint Hills Solar, we'll come up in any kind of a search engine.
For everyone, they've got a wonderful website, and it's very informative to us all. So thank you for that. Now, before we run out of time, I would love to talk about current changes to the utility company's response to the ability of the citizens to make their own electricity. So in recent weeks, I have clearly reported that Westar in Kansas and parts of Kansas City have made a additional charge to people with a solar array on their home because they feel that those people need to help pay to maintain the grid. Robert, what do you think? Should we be paying to maintain the grid, or how? What's your thought on that?
Well, the grid has to be maintained, and the business model of the utility company the last 150 years has been to charge a base rate, which pays for some of the infrastructure, and a percentage of the fixed costs is paid by the base rate, and the rest of it they collect through what they call volumetric charges, the electricity we buy. If people are not buying electricity, then they can't recover those fixed costs. If people don't buy electricity because they installed LED light bulbs, or they conserve, or they add insulation, or they hang their clothes out to dry, are they not paying their fair share too?
Or don't use as much electricity as we've been taught to conserve electricity, right?
Well, yeah, we know we need to conserve electricity, and they've created their business around people not conserving electricity. Now, what they've done and what they petitioned the KCC and what they're doing in Kansas City, Kansas, as well as the rest of Kansas, is, you know, Westar has petitioned the KCC to put demand fees if on solar any distributed generator. That's what they call us. Solar customers are residential distributed generators. So if you have any generation equipment, they want to put a extra fees on your bill to recover the costs. However, what made this particular fee structure so unfair is that it kills most of us who have 10 panels or less or fewer. You know, if you have a few panels, it's going to cost you much more with the demand fees to put up panels. But if you're a large user of electricity, let's say you pay $200 a month, $300 a month in electricity, you will benefit from this new plan. So in their effort to avoid a subsidy, a cross subsidy, they have created a more unjust one that favors only large residential users, which is safe to say wealthy residential users. You probably didn't understand all that because it's very confusing. That's one of the reasons we don't like demand plans, because they are difficult to understand.
We're talking to Robert Rosenberg, co-director from the Flint Hills Renewable Energy and Efficiency Cooperative. So, Robert, Eco Radio KC has made two recent news reports about the response of the utility corporations to self-generated electricity from solar panels. Both, according to the Kansas Corporation Commission, which believes that people who have solar arrays should pay an additional fee monthly in order to help maintain the grid. Is this a good idea? Is this reasonable for the Westar to do?
Oh, it's totally reasonable. It is most efficient to use the grid, this great grid that we have going. Fortunately, we have this modern problem, but there are modern solutions to incorporate distributed generation into the model of generation of the grid. I understand utility company. They're busy. They do a great job. They keep us. They're probably book solid, and they don't really want to have to think about changing things. However, we have the right to put up a solar panel on our roof and generate electricity, and they need to incorporate it instead of trying to thwart it. It's a modern advancement in technology. They admit that in their report to their stockholders, but they list it as a risk to their business model, because they say there's a potential that there's an under recovery of costs, of their fixed costs. Well, there's a chance for that if we all put in LED light bulbs too.
It's easy to see it might be intended to discourage people from mounting solar arrays. But this is going on in Missouri as well. Missouri, our recent report, KCP&L, is allowing users to purchase a solar subscription when they don't even have an array, so that Kansas City Power and Light can have the income to build a solar array, which is the size of 19 football fields. They propose to bring this to the Kansas Corporation Commission as well. What are your thoughts about this move by the utility companies?
Well, renewable energy is, of course, the way to go with on either side of the electric meter, on our side or the utility company. So it's not a surprise that the utility company is investing in solar. What I don't like about utility scale solar arrays is they take up so much land. That could be valuable farmland or pasture or wildlife habitat. it's when there are so many roofs and parking lots that have already been co-opted by humans, why destroy any more? Yeah. I mean, we have a crisis in animal extinctions and declines in I mean, there's so little prairie left in this world, like 6%. Why put solar panels there when we can put them on roofs?
You and I see expansive roofs everywhere that can have solar collectors on them. And I pointed out to you, my favorite use of an on-the-ground solar array is what's being done by Bold, Nebraska, on land which is in the proposed path of the Keystone XL pipeline, so that when Keystone puts up a eminent domain action to condemn that land and get it, they have to pay the landowner for the solar array. That's good use of farm field to have a solar array there. Otherwise, your point is, why put an array on blank, empty ground when we have so much blank, empty space above the ground available to collect electricity from the sun? True.
Right. I mean, sure, it's not necessarily exactly where the distribution centers are for the utility company, and it may cost them a little more. But those are things that I don't know what kind of deals can be struck with mall parking lots and mall rooftops to put solar panels up, and whether it's worth it. But I suspect, and don't know, but I suspect the utility company hasn't even researched doing that. Their model, what they do is, you know, generate electricity with large power plants, and that's what they're accustomed to doing, like Mark Cooper with the American Consumer Federation says, it's, you know, they pour concrete and they boil water, and that's how we make electricity now. 70-60% in Kansas, and I don't know what it is in Missouri, is made from boiling water heated by coal.
Right, that other 40% is nuclear. Don't forget that, Robert.
Well, most of it. There's a lot of wind in Kansas, in like 20-some percent, and which is certainly a step in the right direction. But that also takes up a lot of land that was pasture or animal habitat.
I want to thank you for coming and talking to Eco Radio KC. Listeners, if you have a comment, please go to our Facebook page, Eco Radio KC, or go to the Eco Radio page on kkfi.org and give us your comments. We want to hear feedback. Thank you, Robert. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
This past Saturday, there was a workshop on advancing climate solutions held at Village Presbyterian Church in Prairie Village, Kansas. Eco Radio KC was on hand to record. The following is Catherine Kelly, Executive Director of Cultivate KC.
So I'm going to go at this a little bit differently. I want to highlight the good work that's being happened, but I want to cut very much in the context of drawdown. So I want to start with a quote from Drawdown that will help us frame the importance of agriculture in causing and in saving us from climate change. No other mechanism known to humankind is as effective in addressing global warming as capturing carbon dioxide from the air through photosynthesis. We humans interact with plants in primarily two ways. One is the casual enjoyment we feel when we go through one of the city parks, when we notice trees in our environment. The second way we interact with plants is basically when we eat them, which we do three times a day. Every time we chew and swallow, we are engaging with agriculture and we're impacting carbon levels in our environment. If we eat food that was organically produced, we are generally, though not always, having a positive impact on carbon sequestration. If we eat fruit like apples and pears or nuts from trees, we're helping the farmers sequester carbon in their orchards, especially if they're organic orchards. If we eat beef from cattle that were raised on overgrazed land and then fed corn before slaughter, we are increasing methane and CO2 levels in the air. So another quote from Drawdown. If you add livestock to all other food-related emissions, from farming to deforestation to food waste, what we eat turns out to be the number one cause of global warming. Agriculture. agriculture is incredibly important to this effort. Feeding ourselves, farming, and food distribution is both a cause and a cure for global for climate change. So supporting farmers and promoting sustainable, organic, and regenerative agriculture can be one of the most important acts you do as elected officials in a city and as support staff. So we've been asked to share success stories on the climate change front to highlight the work that's already being done in the metro area. So I'm going to call out not so much necessarily success stories as resources. So strategy number four is switching to a plant-rich diet, eating less meat and more plants. This is basically the motherlode of agriculture as a climate improvement strategy. If we can get consumers to eat more vegetables and less meat, if we can get them to support organic production practices rather than extractive production practices, we can have a huge impact on turning around climate change. So some of the things that are already happening around this in Kansas City. We have more than 24 farmers markets where the majority of vendors sell fresh fruits and vegetables. We have on-farm stands. We have CSA programs that are directly connecting farmers to food, farmers to consumers. Our local food retail options have exploded since I started farming here in 1996. We've had a huge impact on people's diets and on their understanding of and appreciation for farmers and agriculture. One of the organizations in Kansas City is the Kansas City Food Circle. They are out and connecting consumers to farmers and promoting sustainable agriculture and educating like crazy. They're a huge resource for us. Strategy number 11, regenerative agriculture. Agriculture using practices that restore degraded land and increase carbon sequestration. In the KC metro area alone, there are at least 120 farmers who use regenerative, organic, and sustainable practices, some of them as small as a quarter acre, some of them dozens of acres, and as you go out into the country, obviously much larger. Missouri has some 450 certified organic producers. Kansas has at least 25. That's only people who took the time to become certified organic. There are other farmers who are using regenerative practices that don't show up on government rolls quite that way. There's strong organizations promoting sustainable agriculture. The Kansas Rural Center, the Midwest Organic Association, Missouri Rural Crisis Center. There are, relative to where we started, there are so many robust, strong organizations that really have the capacity to partner and to collaborate with you all in your efforts to improve climate change. There are farmers out there, individual farmers, who are acutely aware of our need to keep carbon in the soil and to pull carbon back into the soil, who are using and experimenting with different types of cover cropping systems, production systems. The leader in this field, of course, is the Land Institute in Salina. I think they've got some folks here, and they are developing perennial grain crops that don't require annual planting and tillage, and that are capable of capturing huge amounts of carbon and while producing the grains that we eat so much of. Strategy number 23, farmland restoration, turning abandoned land to productive farm. So urban and peri-urban farmers are buying up vacant lots and turning them into productive urban farms. All of our communities have those underutilized pieces of land, and there are folks looking for that land and trying to turn that soil into fruits and vegetables. Strategies number 28, number 9, and 17, multi-strata agroforestry, silvopasture, tree intercropping. Trees are great at sequestering carbon, and when we plant trees as food producers or facilitators of food production, we have a system that both produces food and also helps with carbon sequestration. In our metro area, we have organizations like the Giving Grove that are planting fruit orchards and berry orchards all over the metro area. We've got something called the KC Permaculture Extension that is helping farmers and home gardeners as well install food forests, producing food while sequestering carbon, improving soil organic matter. The Kansas Rural Center is educating farmers on silvopasture practices where trees are planted at the pastures for a significant increase in carbon sequestration. Strategy number 60, composting. We are lucky to have a business called Missouri Organic Recycling that takes yard and food waste and turns it into compost. Most of our municipalities also have composting operations that could be doing, that are doing a good job, but in fact could be doing more. And in pulling this all out, pulling this together and thinking about this, I started with like a half hour talk and I had to cut it down. What I want to say though that I think you all should know is that in the years to come, we are going to need to understand farmers as resources, as leaders, as innovators, as entrepreneurs, and it is our job, no matter how far into the city and what city neighborhoods you're representing, it's our job to support them and help them do what they do better and help them become part of this effort to turn around climate change. So if you need suggestions for policy changes you can implement, I have a long list of them. We came up with a couple at our table that I thought were really good as well. So thank you for listening to me and thank you for the work you're doing.
Another speaker at the Advancing Climate Solutions Workshop was Dennis Murphy, Chief Environmental Officer of the City of Kansas City, Missouri. Here's what Dennis had to say.
Well, I really want to thank Mayor Kelly and Lindsay Constance for inviting me to be a part of today's program, but I don't appreciate being put on the agenda to follow Sly James. Mayor James is a very tough act to follow. I have to say, he gives me a lot more credit than I deserve, because one of the reasons that we've been able to do what we've accomplished in Kansas City is that we've had a mayor, a city council, and a city manager that have given staff the ability to do the things that we're doing in Kansas City. So thank you very much. I think Mayor James has given you a pretty good overview of the Kansas City story and some of the successes, so I'm going to add just a little bit, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking. As he indicated, we adopted a climate protection plan in 2008. It was unanimously adopted by our mayor and city council. It was a very ambitious plan, as you know. It had ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals, had 55 different strategies to implement, and we've been at it for about a decade. So we've been working in this space for a long time. As you also noted, we do periodic greenhouse gas emission inventory updates. We actually did one in 2013 in partnership with Johnson County. And so we partnered with Johnson County to analyze greenhouse gas emission reductions. And Johnson County not only did their own at the county level, but actually looked at many of the communities in Johnson County as well. Our most recent inventory, as you noted, was 2017. We have achieved a 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in municipal operations and a 21% reduction community-wide. If you recall, we also indicated we had a 30% reduction goal by 2020. That means in local government operations, we've already exceeded our goal. So one of the things we've got facing us now is updating our climate protection plan and even set higher greenhouse gas reduction goals, particularly at the municipal operations level. But we've been particularly pleased to see significant progress in the last 4 or 5 years on a community-wide scale. Everything that we've done in Kansas City in implementing our plan and developing our plan has been through significant partnerships with others. Many of the folks are sitting in this room that we've worked with. We've worked with our local utilities. We've worked with Mid-America Regional Council, with Bridging the Gap, with the Metropolitan Energy Center, with our own internal environmental management commission at the city, and our climate protection plan, which Mayor James referred to, where we had community leaders that worked with us to help establish the framework in which we were going to move forward on climate action. We've also worked with other local governments. We've worked with businesses, the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. We've also worked very closely with many neighborhoods, interested citizens. So it takes all of us working together to achieve the kinds of things that we are addressing in our conversations today. We've worked in the areas of energy efficiency, addressing renewable energy, transportation, waste issues. Housing is a big issue in Kansas City right now, particularly affordable housing. We've worked on food. We focus everything through a lens of achieving social equity. And that's really becoming the case across the country. All cities that are working in this space are increasingly understanding that social equity has to be a fundamental part of what we're doing. One of the exciting things that we've got on the immediate horizon is that we are currently getting ready to start negotiations with KCP&L on procuring 100% of the electricity for municipal operations from renewable energy generation. another classic example of the kind of cooperation we're talking about. The city had identified some time ago that that's a direction we wanted to go, but we couldn't do it without partnership with our local utility. Kansas City Power and Light went to the Missouri Public Service Commission and asked for approval to create a program where their largest customer could procure 100% renewable energy for their operations. Kansas City is KCP&L's largest single customer. We use between 250 and 300 million kilowatt hours a year of electricity. And so that is a dramatic shift for us to go to 100% renewable. We now see it as being something that's achievable within the next year and a half or 2 years. That will push us much further on that goal of an 80% reduction by 2050. We look forward to continuing our work in Kansas City. We're always open to collaborate and work with other communities. We've had the opportunity to share our experiences with other communities. We're welcome to share what we've done, not because we have all the answers, but because we're willing to share the experiences we've had, the lessons we've learned, and if any of those are relevant to other activities and communities across the metropolitan area, we're happy to share them. So thank you.
That was Dennis Murphy, Chief Environmental Officer for the City of Kansas City, Missouri, speaking at this past weekend's Advancing Climate Solutions Workshop and Seminar. The calendar of events for the week of December 10th. December 12th, 10 a.m. at Baker Wetlands, 1365 West 1250 Road, Lawrence, Kansas. A program for children under 5 will include a walk, story time, and a craft to learn what hibernation is. Children must be accompanied by an adult and registration is required. Register by calling the Wetlands at 785-594-4703. This is a free event. It happens again on 1213. On December 12, 4 to 6 p.m., the Kansas City, Missouri Environmental Management Commission meeting will occur at Kansas City, Missouri Health Department, 2400 Troost Avenue, Suite 4600, Kansas City, Missouri. The meetings are open to the general public. For more information, go to KCMO-EMC. On December 13th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., create holiday edible decorations for the wild winter residents of Burr Oak Woods Conservation Nature Center and then venture out to garnish a tree for birds and other critters. 1401 Northwest Park Road, Blue Springs, Missouri. This is a free class, but online registration is required at Burr Oak. Organizers encourage participants to dress for the weather. December 12th, 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., there'll be a Little Blue River litter cleanup at 8700 George Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Volunteer to clean up litter in the Little Blue River watershed near Nolan Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Minimum age 16. All volunteers must register in advance. Contact John at 816-944-2383 or email john.fish@bridgingthegap.org. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page.